Every single human being has an aspect of himself that is invisible and yet very real. This aspect of himself, which is non-material, is a field of higher intelligence, is a window to a more universal field of infinite possibilities. When you get in touch with this aspect of yourself, this higher self, you find that there's an aspect of yours which has a computing ability which is far more precise, far more accurate, and far more orderly than that which exists in the realm of rational thought. For most people, spirituality has not been a very practical matter. As children, we all ask questions. What is life about? Where was I before I was born? What happens to me when I die? Why do things turn out the way they do? Is there a plan, a purpose behind the universe? Our parents provided us with few satisfactory answers to these deep questions. And as we grew up, we stopped asking them. Our concerns about deep values became secondary to the everyday thoughts, desires, and actions that fill up everyone's existence. Earning a living and raising a family are matters I must attend to here and now. Examining the purpose of my being here does not demand my immediate attention. For thousands of years, man has acknowledged that he has a spirit, an invisible aspect of himself that is connected to a higher reality, to God, to the higher self, or the soul. In some way, most people still sense, however vaguely, that this aspect of themselves cannot be ignored forever. In everyday terms, though, this age-old belief in a higher reality does not actualize itself. Why not? First of all, appearances are set against anything non-material. We are surrounded by a solid physical world in which spirit seems to exert no force, or at best a debatable influence. Moreover, leaving aside specific religious beliefs, there is a general sense that spirit is basically separate from us. Our bodies process food, air, and water perfectly well without spirit. Our minds effectively think about a million things without touching upon spirit. We find it easy to set spiritual life aside, waiting for the day when some as yet impossible leap takes us out of everyday life into a more exalted realm. Spirituality is a practical matter. So if we want to talk about it, we have to pierce the veil of physical appearances. We have to go beyond the belief system that ties us to matter as real and the non-material as unreal. We all have a bias towards things we can see, feel, hear, taste, and smell. If you look at all the notions we accept about who we are, you find that they're all based upon perceptual experiences. If you can see yourself as an isolated ego encapsulated in a package of skin and bones, this is because you can touch your skin, feel the hardness of your bones, and experience the thoughts and emotions that give your ego, your identity, its center of reference. Our bias tells us that we are a material body that has somehow learned to think. Dancing molecules in our brains create all the ideas and emotions that we identify with. But it is possible to have other experiences, equally valid, equally indisputable, that would tell us that we are much more than a body and ego, even more than body and mind. Instead of occupying a few cubic feet of space and a narrow sliver of time, we can shift our sense of self to an unbounded reality that has infinite dimensions. This higher sense of self cannot be found somewhere out there. Being an aspect of ourselves, our spirit is in here with everything else that is us. At the core of our being, the experience of spirit is not just real, it is the most real thing about us. Far from being detached from body, mind, and ego, spirit animates them all, connects them all, is them all. Although our package of skin and bones looks very convincing, it is a mask, an illusion, disguising our true self, which has no limitations. Can the higher self be awakened and integrated into everyday life? The whole process of spiritual unfoldment begins with that question, with the tantalizing possibility that on my own I can find out if indeed I am infinite instead of finite, powerful instead of weak, connected with the entire cosmos instead of isolated on a ball of rock spinning around a mediocre star. To give us a clue about what it would mean to exist beyond our accustomed boundaries, let's examine the most basic limitations we all accept: time, space, and matter. Matter seems like a good place to begin. The solidity of the world seems totally indisputable. As a fixed thing that you can see and touch, your body is also reassuringly solid. But beginning with Einstein, modern physics has assured us that this solidity is a mirage. After all, the body is made up of atoms. These atoms are particles that are whirling at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces. And the particles aren't material objects. They are fluctuations of energy and information in a huge void of energy and information. If you could see the body as it really is, you'd see that 99.9999% of it is mostly empty space. And the 0.00001% of it, which you see as matter, is also empty space. The matter is just an illusion, an artifact of our perceptual experiences. As you sift through this very solid-looking material body, you only have to go so far before you end up with a handful of nothing. This is a scientific fact. The question is, what is this nothingness? What is this empty space that makes up everything in existence? Because it's very clear that the basic raw material of the universe is that it's not material. The essential stuff of the universe is non-stuff. Because an atom, which is the basic unit of matter, is not really a solid entity. It's a void. But is this void an emptiness? Or could it be the womb of creation itself? Could it be the source of life itself? Is this non-stuff, non-matter that makes up the entire universe just emptiness? Or is it thinking non-stuff, thinking non-matter, that curves back within its own self and creates everything in existence, from matter to energy to time to space? As you dissect through the body, the various layers of organs, tissues, cells, molecules, and atoms peel away until at the subatomic realm, all that remains are bundles of energy vibrations. The nerve receptors in the body are switching stations that can take energy vibrations and turn them into touch, sight, sound, and so on. The only reason that a femur seems hard, plasma wet, and hemoglobin red is by a trick of our senses. Behind us, as a scientist once said, there is a radically ambiguous, ceaselessly flowing quantum soup. And the moment you turn around, like magicians, you turn it into solid physical reality. Through the mechanics of perception, out there is a quantum soup. In here is the world created. We're like King Midas, who could never know the true texture of a rose or the soft caress of a kiss, because everything he touched turned into gold. Literally, like that, in waking state of consciousness, we will never know the true texture of quantum reality. Only in higher states of consciousness, which we're going to talk about in this program, we can literally see that this whole world is a projection of our consciousness. As the poet Rumi said, we come whirling out of nothingness, scattering stars like dust. We have a whole different reality. We have to wake up to it. Just like when you wake up from your dream state, you can look back on the dream and you say, aha, that was the dream. So too, you can wake up from ordinary everyday reality, wake up to this higher reality, and then you look back and you say, aha, that was just another reality. I can open up to a higher dimension in which, in fact, I become a true magician. My desires get fulfilled at the mere intention of having them. I see that everything that happens to me is self-created, that whenever I'm responding to any situation, whether it's a sip of coffee or a traffic jam or a love note or criticism from a boss or rainy weather, I'm in fact responding to a signal that I generated within myself. The Vedic scriptures, on which a lot of this is based, say, curving back within myself, I create again and again and again. I create my mind, I create my body, I create my perceptual experiences. In fact, for the entire universe that I experience, I am the subtle cause. When you wake up to this reality, you recognize that the objective facts on which you casually base your reality, although fundamentally valid, are not all there is. There is a dimension to reality which has been hidden from your perceptual experiences, which is the subtle cause of this material reality. In fact, you can change material reality by going to that higher self. The key word is that our objective reality is fundamentally valid because our bodies seem real enough for all practical purposes. Yet reality is like a hero sandwich constructed from many dissimilar layers. If you are content to remain at the layer where bones are hard and plasma wet and hemoglobin red and the material world real, that will be your reality. Expanding one's reality means probing into subtler layers of nature until you reach the ultimate layer where solidity, texture, and color all vanish into pure potentiality, into nothingness, but not an emptiness, the nothingness which is the womb of creation itself, the inner space which sends out messengers that make up your reality. However, this nothingness, as I said before, is not so much a void as a womb, which gives birth to every material and immaterial expression in the universe. The world you see, hear, and touch represents only a minute fraction of the entire spectrum of nature, no more than a few narrow channels on an infinite radio band. And few is not enough. By rigidly adhering to the boundaries of the senses, we are letting most of life slip away through our fingers. To keep everyday reality going, we have agreed to certain arbitrary rules and conventions about where reality begins and where it ends. Objective science is the keeper of these rules, performing an extremely valuable task so long as we remember that these rules are meant to be broken. So let's talk about time. What is time? Ask a physicist. Has anyone done an experiment that shows the existence of time? In fact, no respectable physicist since the year 1913 has used the word time by itself. They talk about space-time continuums because time as we experience it is a psychological event, is a concept that we have invented in order to experience or to explain our experience of change. What I'm suggesting is that reality is much more flexible than people realize, even the reality of time, programmed by our past beliefs, which we inherited from our parents and our cultural traditions sometimes, and our indoctrination by society, the hypnosis of social conditioning, we remain localized in the boundaries handed down from generation to generation. We refuse to see that reality is open to revision. Nothing has to be accepted just because we inherited it. Thanks to our spiritual dimension, which we can define as that aspect of ourselves that does not believe in limitations because it does not experience them, we can challenge the most basic boundaries that enclose us. A wise teacher, a wise rishi in India once said to his disciple, to his student, he said, "You have enclosed yourself in a prison of space, time, and causation, squeezed yourself into the volume of a body and the span of a lifetime, when in fact you are limitless, unbounded. This world that you see is of your own creation. It is an artifact of your own perception, when you really know your spiritual dimension, you will realize that you're not in the body is in you. You're not in the mind is in you. You're not even in the world is in you. Body, mind, and world happen to you because you find them interesting. Curving back within yourself, you create it all. We have already talked about the illusion of matter, but time is a similar illusion. A clock tells time by ticking away the hours and minutes, independent of our influence. But from another viewpoint, all this is only a show of objectivity. We have made a collective agreement that time has certain unalterable features. It moves forward. It is measured by clocks. It is uniform everywhere, and it waits for no man. Yet this agreement is not ironclad, and at certain moments, time turns inexplicably flexible. Recently, a Swiss friend of mine, also a physician, read me a curious and moving newspaper story about a coal mine disaster in Germany. A small group of miners were trapped underground after a massive cave-in. They realized that the air in the mine shaft would last only a limited number of hours. As it turned out, only one of the group was wearing a wristwatch, and he began to announce the time while the group anxiously waited for rescue. And to sustain hope in the others, he did not announce the right time. Instead, he called out 1 hour whenever 2 hours had actually passed. 6 days later, a rescue team found the men and were astonished that they were all still alive, with one exception, the man who wore the watch. In essence, the man with the watch fooled the others into breaking their agreement about what constituted real time. Tragically, he could not fool himself. Can it be that time will wait for one man and overtake another, depending on what each one expects? Recently, I read another case report about a study that was done in California in the spring of 1990. Sociologists from the University of California and San Diego reported that Chinese mortality dropped by 35% the week before the Harvest Moon Festival, one of the most auspicious days in the Chinese calendar, and one where special importance is given to elders. When the festival ended, death rates climbed again, and by a week later were 34% higher than normal. This really implies that people who are near death can postpone their passing in order to savor a day that is special to them. They have beaten time itself. Finally, cardiologists have pondered the fact that heart attacks are higher at 9 o'clock on Monday morning than in any other time of the week. This is not exactly a randomly chosen hour. For many people, going back to work after the weekend is a return to harsher realities. Have some of them found the drastic escape route of suffering a heart attack instead of punching the time clock again? These examples are limited to biological time, the hidden clock in ourselves. To see truly comprehensive mastery of time, one must turn to dreams. In your dreams, time lacks any fixed sequence or logic altogether. It can go backwards or forwards, speed up or slow down, come to a halt or simply disappear. Many dream events are frozen in a kind of no time, without beginning, without ending. When we wake up to the world of reliable clocks, time resumes its creeping pace, but that proves little about its real nature. Suppose a man is sitting in a room, idly looking out the window. Morning, noon, and evening go by. He passively stares at people as they parade before him and watches the events taking place on the street. The same man could go to sleep at night and witness the exact same people and events in a dream, but now morning, noon, and evening occupy only 2 minutes of his sleep. Like the rest of his dream, time was created by his brain. In what way is waking time any different? The same brain processes the passage of time in both cases. Therefore, waking time and dream time could both be self-created. You know, and if you read Stephen Hawking's book, Brief History of Time, in the introduction by Carl Sagan, you find the following statement. It says, Stephen Hawking set out to understand the mind of God, came to the conclusion that we live in a universe that has no beginning in time, no ending in time, no outer edges in space. Please try and conceptualize that, visualize that with all your might, and you'll find that it's impossible. How can you even conceptualize or visualize or imagine a beginningless universe, something that never began? So, of course, you might want to compromise and say maybe there was a beginning. And then the immediate dilemma is, what's there before the beginning? If you say there's an end, then the immediate dilemma is, what's there after the end? If you say there are outer edges in space, the immediate dilemma is, what's there after the outermost edge? So you see, quantum physics is not only stranger than we think it is, it's stranger than we can think. Because the way we can think, rationality, logically structured, linguistically structured, verbally elite thought, is just a justification of our reality map, which is based on material existence. When the reality map changes, then the territory changes also. The true nature of reality is that it is infinite, unbounded, eternal. It is the process of thinking that takes that unbounded, infinite nature of the universe and breaks them into conceptual boundaries. This is so-called rationality, linguistically structured thought, a justification for our reality map. There's no worse fate than to be caught in the clutches of this kind of rationality, because it prevents you from getting in touch with that higher self. So, if time itself is only a personal perception, liable to the same fluctuations as mood, reverie, fantasy, or any other passing thought, then we should be able to change it. All of us exercise some ability to manipulate time according to our whims. If I'm languishing in a dentist's waiting room, my unhappiness makes time drag. To speed it up, I need only go somewhere else, perhaps to a good restaurant, where I can enjoy myself again. If I've turned to something I find deeply enjoyable, time begins to fly. The difference between slow time, dragging time, and swift, fleeting time resides in me, in my perception of the situation. As long as I am free to move from the dentist to the restaurant, I have personal control over how it feels to me, how I experience time, because ultimately time is conceived in consciousness, it's processed in the brain, and it is metabolized in the body. I take that experience of time, which is non-material, and turn it into a biological clock. And how I do that really determines many things, including how I age, how entropy or disorder takes place in my life, whether I'm healthy or not. All these are based on personal perceptions of time. The flow of linear time is a purely psychological event. For example, if I'm forced by a sense of duty to remain at the dentist's, then I have no choice but to experience the creeping kind of time that is offered there. This sort of compulsion has trapped us all. We stay in the same time frame day after day because we think we have to or ought to. But this is only an agreement we made somewhere along the line. We have even forgotten when, in reality, anyone can break free and reassert their ability to control time. Most people have a time-bound awareness. And the reason is they have sacrificed their self for their self-image. The self-image is our social persona, the protective veneer, the mask behind which we hide. The self-image is intellectual, it calculates, it determines its behaviors in anticipation of other people's responses. The self-image, therefore, is a fear-based, time-bound awareness. On the other hand, the self feels. It's from the heart. The self has a built-in response to every situation as it occurs. The awareness of the self is supremely concentrated in the present. The self doesn't calculate. It feels, and it goes with the feeling, the right response to every situation as it occurs, because life is so supremely concentrated in the present. When we go back to ourself, the higher self, and we'll be talking about various means to do that, then we'll realize that, in fact, here there is only eternity, that we can carry the consciousness of eternity wherever we go. I was quoting this Indian teacher from a little while ago who said to his student, you've trapped yourself in the boundaries of space, time, and causation. And this is because of your self-imposed illusion. And all your conflicts arise because of this. Birth and death, pain and pleasure, hope and fear. To end these problems, you must first end the illusion. But how's this done? The student asked. And the master replied, you are caught in this world like a fish in a net. But all nets have holes. Find one, escape through it, and you will see what reality actually is. Time is just such a net. It appears objectively real, but in fact, maybe no more than a notion fostered in our minds. If we understand at a very deep level of our awareness that the flow of time is a psychological event, and how we experience time is up to us, then just that insight, just that knowledge can cause a mutation in our awareness. And when that change occurs in our awareness, then the body responds, because the body is nothing other than an expression, a projection, a three-dimensional movie that is being projected by that spirit, by that essential ground state from where we come. Our basic mistake is that we tend to think that time is outside of us, but it is just as much inside, packaged as memory. To remember is to take your body time traveling, even though you do not leave your chair. For example, if I vividly remember being scared in a dark alley when I was six, my heart starts to thump like a six-year-old's again. The mind can also project the body forward in time. I have seen 20-year-old women, on being told that they have cancer, instantly age before my eyes, becoming as worn as someone who has battled the disease for years. What we are seeing here is that to go beyond time simply means to reclaim your right to control time as a basic aspect of yourself. Living in the eternal present, which sounds like such a lofty spiritual goal, just comes down to recovering yourself and knowing what you can do. Most of us have no idea what we can do because we are totally conditioned by the past. Our memories, beliefs, assumptions, prejudices, and stresses conspire to trap us in one boundary after another. We need to escape from this. We need to escape from the known. Most people talk about fear of the unknown. If there's anything to fear, it is the known. Because the known is the rigid patterns of past conditioning. The unknown is the field of infinite possibilities. That field of infinite choices into which we can step every moment of our life when we go beyond the camouflage of our past memories, our conditioning. Then we begin to see the world with fresh eyes, through the eyes of innocence, through the eyes of a child, through the eyes of God. And this process comes about by going beyond thought. It comes about by going into the gap between our thoughts. Because I'm not my thoughts. I'm the thinker who has those thoughts. And that part of me is unchanged. It is the timeless essence in every experience. In every experience, there is one aspect of that experience that never changes. That's the experiencer. To get in touch with the experiencer, T.S. Eliot once said, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. That place is timeless. Judgment is one of the most important ways that the mind has for feeling good about itself. Anytime we find ourselves in a psychologically threatening situation, the mind faces a decision. Will this person hurt me? Is it dangerous to feel this emotion? Dare I say what I really think? Whatever answer the mind comes up with becomes the provisional reality we operate with. And the shifting, jumbled heap that these provisional realities amount to becomes reality itself. Since life never ceases bringing us a new wave of challenge every day, the intellectual decisions we make spin on forever. The number of questions that arise over the tiniest experience is awe-inspiring. Making correct choices enables us to feel better about ourselves. Instead of having an angry outburst at a rude sales clerk, we refrain, choosing instead to do the quote-unquote right thing. And this control over our anger brings a measure of satisfaction. It is almost inconceivable to the mind that it might operate non-judgmentally. The very idea arouses considerable fear, particularly if one has accepted the prevailing notion that the world is a dangerous place, to be negotiated with care. Judgments of every kind have been ingrained in all of us since childhood. They form the bulk of our past conditioning, and therefore it is crucial to look at the whole mechanism of judgment if we want to get past our conditioning into a new area of personal freedom. Calling someone judgmental can be taken as a serious affront because it implies a habit of condemning and criticizing. A judgmental person looks for faults in others to disguise his own faults. He puts other people's weaknesses in a glaring light in order to achieve a false sense of strength for himself. As they mature, most people try to overcome these tendencies, and our society places a high value on tolerance and openness towards other people's viewpoints. However, the mechanism of judgment plays such an indispensable part in the mind that we can fairly say it is present in all of us, whether we consider ourselves judgmental or not. It is only natural to want to feel that you've made right choices in your life. This implies a whole host of wrong choices that could have been made. And lurking behind all those wrong choices is the mind's habit of using right and wrong as a basic criterion for decision-making. There is a hidden trap, however, in the assumption that right and wrong are necessary. How can we ever be certain that we have truly seen what is right and what is wrong? Isn't there the possibility that we are instead making things right and wrong? Setting up our own judgments as law without examining if they were really made on a trustworthy basis? If I see an old enemy who insulted me 10 years ago, I will find it almost impossible to overlook my former injury. The old image crops up in my mind, automatically, erecting a wall, and the person who could have been my friend is shut out, rejected in advance. In turn, when he senses my coldness, his defenses are raised until we both find ourselves hiding behind barricades that serve no purpose, that lack all reality. The moment of judgment may soon pass, and yet there is no relationship at all with my old enemy, quote-unquote, only the stale repetition of outworn memories. And the horror is that my tormentor today is myself left over from yesterday. So by allowing our judgments to camouflage our present experiences, we lose touch with reality. We are no longer alive, no longer sensitive to the presence of our spirit, our awareness, our eternal being that animates every moment of our existence. In and of itself, reality is neither right nor wrong. Reality exists. It has the quality of being, which is the supreme quality of life. If we tried to withstand the full force of life in its infinite power, our minds would be overwhelmed in one instant. Billions of bits of sense data bombard us every second, out of which we choose an extremely narrow band to be labeled as real. This process of selecting and narrowing down happens automatically through our senses. Our eyes cannot see the infrared light sensed by snakes. Our ears cannot hear the ultrasound picked up by bats. Our sense of touch cannot feel the ground shake when another person approaches us, although that is evident to almost all small mammals. The fact that our senses hem us in does not automatically lead to psychological damage. There are other, much more dangerous boundaries imposed by the intellect. The intellect is the mind's decision maker. The intellect looks upon the vast array of possibilities afforded by every moment of life and naturally feels overwhelmed. So it has decided to make models. A model is a small representation, a reduction of the real thing. We all carry them around in our heads. We have an idea of the model child, the model woman, the model lifestyle. Often we call these our ideals. To say I didn't have an ideal childhood basically means the way you were treated by your parents doesn't live up to a model of child rearing you have stored inside your head. Models are extremely useful because whenever we come up against a new experience, we can hold a model up, judge how the new experience compares to it, and instantly know where we stand. Using models, we convert the unknown into the known. For a new experience is always unknown, while our past, the source of our models, is reassuringly known. The mind craves continuity. It doesn't want to be surprised by every moment of existence. Therefore, no matter how open-minded you consider yourself, relying on inner models forms an important part of your everyday mental activity. It's important to realize that those models, those pictures of reality that we carry around inside, are not reality itself. They do not convey the inner content of experience except as it matches some old context. Take an example as simple as eating an ice cream cone. We all know that this simple act is rarely free of value judgments. Will eating this make me fat? Will it spoil my appetite? Was I good enough to reward myself this way? Is this brand as good as brand X? Will I ever find the ideal chocolate ice cream? Such questions endlessly arise from the insignificant act of eating an ice cream cone. They arouse powerful feelings in us because we all identify with the context that makes this small act meaningful. In the process of mistaking the model for the real thing, the context for the content, the genuine experience of eating an ice cream cone slips through our fingers. A context is just a personal association that you have with something. And eating is full of contextual meaning for everyone, arousing extremely powerful emotions that have nothing to do with the actual content of any meal. I have met anorexic patients who feel faint and nauseated at the sight of dessert. For them, contextual feelings can be crippling. They are so out of proportion with the simple act of eating. Even though it is easy to see how judgments bring great limitation to our lives, the mind will struggle desperately to hold on to them, because judgment is both a defense and a means of being happy. As a means of being happy, it gives us neat slices of reality, our personal likes and dislikes, that we can take pride in. What I like is me, what I dislike is not me, but neither one is you. As a means of creating happiness, this whole business of making right and making wrong defers happiness. The Chinese poet Wu Men has written these haunting lines. 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. The unnecessary things of which he speaks are judgments. You can instantly tell if someone is free of judgments by asking if this is the best time in his life. If he's truly without judgment, which means without regrets or expectations, the answer has to be yes. There is no other choice. The judging mind has been so ingrained with deferring experience that even its moments of deepest happiness are shadowed by the prospect of something better or something worse. Something I wish I hadn't done. Something I want to do but can't. And this brings in the role of using judgments as defense. We all defend ourselves with self-justifications, knowing deep down that we cannot face the risk of asking for total happiness. We say things like, I'm too busy now. I'll be happy when I'm successful. Today is not a good day. I'll be happy tomorrow. I can't be happy with you. You're not up to my standards. I'll be happy when I get what I want. Life is less risky if you're good and measure up to the norm. I'm happy as the next person. How often have we used such phrases to justify a basic sense of self-defeat? In each rationalization, one hears the victory of the head over the heart. The heart's most fundamental desire, to be content in the here and now, without doubt or equivocations, has been denied. The experience of being happy is no longer immediate. It has become a distant or near prospect, an idea rather than a feeling. The trap of judgment is that one begins to believe that such self-imposed limitation is completely justified. A person who says, I have found the world's best chocolate ice cream, feels a certain sense of added self-esteem in having made that judgment. At the same time, he's guarding himself from the fear that his self-esteem may need such artificial bolstering to keep it from collapsing altogether. Rationally, the mind knows that no brand of ice cream, no make of car, no huge salary or palatial house is the same as me. I am this ice cream cone is an absurd statement, yet judgment is basically equating the two. Most people find it extremely difficult to tell someone how much money they actually make. This is because they believe at the gut level of emotion that I am worth only what I earn. Even if your salary runs into seven figures, to equate yourself with your earning ability misses one fundamental point. You are of infinite worth, and no amount of money can possibly equal that. Infinite worth has to be experienced, however, in order to be real. It is a subjective status that causes objective reality to present a different face. The process of rising to any higher status begins inside and is then mirrored outside. So by relying on judgment, we stunt the process of self-expansion or shut it down entirely. Every time you impose a model over reality, you are judging. And in judging, you are limiting yourself. Inside each of us, there is an infallible knower, which has the capacity to withstand the full force of reality and welcome it joyfully. No amount of love can threaten or overwhelm it. No emotion is beyond its acceptance. No outer experience can shake its unbounded status. So we have to make a distinction between this inner knower and the mind with all its judgments. The distinction has to do with the directness of experience. To the knower, all experience comes directly without filters or defenses. To the mind, on the other hand, all experience is indirect, because it has to be sifted through the judgment process. Let me dwell for a moment on the experience of being loved. To a newborn baby, the whole issue of whether it deserves to be loved doesn't exist. Babies feel extreme delight, the loving touch and glance of their mothers. The bonding of self and experience is total. This is as close to unconditional love as most people get in their lifetime, despite the fact that a baby is not really loving unconditionally. Its love precedes conditions. Once the mother shows anger or disapproval, conditions start to arise. The message is sent, I won't love you unless. Children receive these messages with great intuitive accuracy. And within the first year, they have learned to gauge how much love it is safe to give or receive. How much affection can be demanded under what circumstances. The whole process of judging reality has begun. It is undeniably true that every adult carries a buried child within. But even more important, I think, is this more basic entity, judgment, that began in earliest childhood. A person who has worked through childhood pain will still feel perfectly right in judging how much love to give or receive, accept or reject. The love between husband and wife is different than that between friends. The total acceptance a mother might feel for her own child is not extended to a child down the block, much less to a child in Ethiopia. Instead of considering that all love might be perfect, the mind weighs love according to each situation. Nor is this a conscious act, since we cannot help feeling much more love for certain people than for others, as our past conditioning dictates. Love is a highly charged word for all of us. We feel threatened if someone implies that we are unloving or unlovable. Yet if we trace our judgments back to their source, the root cause of our problems with love rests on those little decisions made long ago in childhood that separated us from love itself. The direct, unlimited, unjudged love each of us deserves. Love has been judged against because we have judged against ourselves. Now you can see how very different are the two modes which nature has opened to us. The mode of the knower, who accepts reality directly, and the mode of the judgmental mind, which screens reality through models. Ask where reality can be found. It is nowhere but in the direct experience of the inner knower. Being in the present moment, the knower has no sense of guilt from the past or fear of the future. These two ingredients are embedded in all judgments. Our great need to label things as good and bad, right and wrong, is based on the pain we experienced when we were judged as good or bad, right or wrong. Guilt reminds us which things these are. Fear warns us that they may again arise tomorrow. Strangely, we keep paying the price for punishment we have already received. The knower is above punishment because it accepts that the price has already been paid for past mistakes. Nature's deepest form of forgiveness is to allow us to forget the past. Guilt believes otherwise, insisting on unending atonement every time a past mistake is remembered. The knower is above punishment because it has relinquished its need to judge. Today I will judge nothing that occurs. Non-judgment creates silence in my mind. I'll shed the burden of judgment that I have carried with me. It's a heavy burden. And when I shed it, I'll be free as a leaf in the wind. It's a huge burden. It is to associate memories with certain events, and then every time we are confronted with any situation, we evoke that past memory. The boundaries that the human mind lives inside are invariably fashioned from the past. It is yesterday's hurt that I am defending against today. Last year's glory I want to relive. A bygone love I want to find again. Yet no matter how gratifying one aspect of life becomes, its satisfaction is limited. It wears itself out unless one finds a way to remain connected to the source of renewal. Renewal is one of life's primary urges, but even more important, since all of life depends upon it to keep ahead of tireless destruction. There is never pure destruction in nature, but creation and destruction go together, so closely spliced that they cannot be separated. We are constantly dying and being born at the same instant. Every minute, millions of ourselves divide, giving up their old existence in a death that gives birth to new cells. The impulse of creation pushes life ahead, even while the past is gobbling up life from behind. We have a deep psychological drive to keep pace with this process. Alice Miller puts it with beautiful conciseness. To quote her, there are needs that can and should be satisfied in the present. Among these is every human being's central need to express himself, to show himself to the world as he really is, in word, in gesture, in behavior, in every genuine utterance from the baby's cry to the artist's creation. The key to this inspiring affirmation is that life needs to be satisfying in the present. The great physicist Erwin Schrödinger once remarked, "The present is the only thing that has no end." By this he meant that each second of time is an eternal renewal. From one perspective, the present is the thinnest possible slice of time, the fleeting instant that allows the future to flip-flop into the past. From the opposite perspective, the present is eternal, because it is ever-renewing, like a river that is never the same twice. If you think about it, you will realize that the present moment is also the one thing you cannot capture in any image or any model. There is no time even to apply a model. In this realization, there's a tremendous sense of freedom. Because as soon as the present is accepted for what it is, unending, unique, unjudgeable, every second of life becomes inclusive. Again, to quote a rishi, said, have your attention on what is and see its fullness in every moment. There is nothing except what is here now. Therefore, the now is everything. If you seek the joy, this freedom begins, know that it must be independent of everything you have been judging as painful or pleasurable. Freedom is nothing but being yourself. It rests on the basic feeling of I am, which has no connotation of pain or pleasure, only the peace of existing for your own sake, which is the highest bliss. Again, to quote Athiya, said, happiness, which has reasons for it, is only another form of misery. But bliss is when you're happy for no reason whatsoever, in the mere fact of existence. And when I know this bliss, then I know that it is closer to me than my mind, nearer to me than my body, and it follows me wherever I go. Your inner knower is in contact with the source of renewal. If only you can get past the judgments that separate you from that ever-present experience. This requires the basic decision to seek happiness not in outside things, but in yourself, which we've already discussed as the starting point of spiritual unfoldment. Once you begin to refer to yourself as the source, the goal, and the path toward all happiness, judgment begins to dissolve, because it is no longer necessary. An ego that looks out on a dangerous world feels threatened because everything out there is unpredictable. The self is ever the same, however, and present in all things. Therefore, it has nothing to fear and nothing to defend against. It replaces the need to judge with one thing, complete acceptance. Judgment would be much easier to eliminate if we could face it directly. But a strong force called denial must be confronted first. Denial basically is the feeling that judgment is not being held. It says, I'm not making right or making wrong. Things just are right or wrong. The most fearful people often think they have no fear at all, because their minds deny that fear is a personal construct. To them, being afraid to fly is only logical, since airplanes do sometimes crash. Being afraid of failure is reasonable, because failure occurs all the time. Being afraid of death is inevitable, because everybody dies. Denial also sets the trap that there is no problem. The myth we cling to of, I'm not afraid, I'm not guilty, I hold on to anger, enables us to maintain a sense of self-control. It confers power at the expense of feeling, and unfortunately, many people are ready to make that bargain. In return for feeling numb against fear, guilt, anger, and pain, they can believe in their supreme self-control. This bargain exacts a high price, however. Denial makes it literally impossible for the flow of bliss to be experienced, because bliss rides on the current of natural feeling. The rigidity of self-control also dooms us to constantly repeating the same basic habits, obsessing about the same complaints, being driven into the same compulsive acts. Repetition is inevitable when you refuse to give space to the present moment. Denial also takes an enormous amount of effort, because the fear and distrust that underlie that have to be kept down forcefully. At its most desperate, denial will also extend to controlling others. those friends and family who might expose the obvious conflicts that boil inside us. Since we live in a materialistic society, all these negative consequences could still be ignored since they are merely psychological, and the whole message of denial is that the psyche deserves its discomfort. But now we know that suppressing our real feelings leads to risks of illness ranging from migraine and hypertension to increased incidence of heart attacks and cancer. The need to make wrong creates intolerable negativity in all areas of life. How then do we break through denial and begin to banish judgments? Psychological means are often of limited value, since by definition, denial consists of those things you don't want to see. They lie on the blind side that all of us have kept hidden as long as we can. Yet denial is really only a wrinkle in our consciousness, a peculiarly deep stress, but a stress nonetheless. Therefore, through meditation, the deep dissolving of stress releases denial and allows judgments to melt away. As the mind settles into its own deeper nature, it fuses with the knower. This automatically removes the duality between mind and knower. Direct experience becomes a real possibility once more. The knower feels no need to analyze and confront one's judgments. Instead, one will just be. And anyone who can just be has no desire to judge. We should all anticipate this effortless release of inner judgments. But along the way, certain attitudes are very helpful. First, forgive yourself for judging. Realize that holding judgment was a necessary phase for your mind to go through as long as it needed to defend yourself. Acknowledging that you hold judgments will enable them to go away more quickly. To maintain that you are non-judgmental is denial, the main defense that all judgment hides behind. You can sincerely say it's okay for my mind to be judgmental because you're simply accepting a fact. Moreover, to forgive yourself for making judgments eliminates the need to examine every judgment one at a time. We have all spent years deciding right and wrong, good and bad. We've wasted enormous energy making other people worthy or unworthy in our eyes. Trying to forgive yourself for all these judgments is both unrealistic and pointless. As you cease to see yourself in terms of what your mind likes or dislikes, the absence of judgment will do much more than make you happier. It will open up a new world in which complete fulfillment is the normal expectation in every moment. The knower is always fulfilled. It knows no other state. The mind, however, always needs to ask, am I really enjoying this? You know, every time you experience judgment, you'll also experience some discomfort in your body. It's an automatic mechanism that occurs. Anytime you are judging, there will be a signal. The universe is very intelligent. Flow of creative intelligence in the universe, very smart, sends you two signals all the time. One's a signal of comfort, the other's a signal of discomfort. Every time you catch yourself judging, just go inside your body and feel that signal of discomfort. It'll remind you, today I shall judge nothing that occurs. Non-judgment creates silence in my mind. And when there's silence in my mind, then there's the flow of bliss in my body. To be free of its defensiveness, the mind must be joined with the knower. Bolstered by inner contentment, your mind will no longer resort to obsessions and compulsions because it will not need them. The whole issue of self-control will evaporate, and the energy wasted in suppressing one's true feelings will be released for the all-important business of living life to the fullest. Every present moment will offer itself as it truly is, a window onto eternity, a doorway to the infinite. At every stage of spiritual growth, the greatest ally you have is your body. Does this statement sound surprising? Most of us tend to assume that body and spirit stand at opposite ends of the spectrum. When we feel sensations that are body-centered, such as hunger and thirst, pain and pleasure, or even happiness and sadness, we do not think of these as spiritual experiences. Sensuousness, which encompasses the whole range of physical delight, is often considered low compared to the heights of the soul. But spirituality is sensuous, because a spiritual person is someone who lives fully in the present moment, which means living fully in the body. As you cross from ordinary waking state to higher states of awareness, the body serves as your vehicle. It is not a leaky boat you hope will get you there before you sink it. No, if you are truly in tune with your body, it becomes a trusted teacher and a trusted guide. In order to trust your body as a guide, the first step is to begin to understand it. The human body, and particularly the brain and central nervous system, functions as a two-way antenna monitoring the reality out there, but also reality in here. From moment to moment, each of us receives a steady flow of information that enters through the five senses, gets processed by the mind, and is eventually converted into the body. I see an apple pie, I feel hungry, and I take a slice. In that simple act, I am processing a piece of the world into myself. But you can also reverse the flow. When the body has a need, it tells the mind, which goes and looks for a source of fulfillment. For example, if my kidneys detect a fluid shortage in the bloodstream, they secrete a hormone, a specific chemical messenger, which reaches the brain and is converted into a mental event. I feel thirsty. See this intimate connection? Back and forth these messages go, from body to mind, from mind to body, creating the balanced flow of life. They form a circle of constantly changing desires, a river that is in me, that is me. As spiritual unfoldment becomes conscious, the circle of life acquires another dimension. Your sense of self expands with no end in sight. More and more experience is allowed to come into the never-ending conversation that each of us is conducting with all 50 trillion cells in our body. Unfortunately, our culture has made the mistake of deciding that the human body is a machine, an inert lump of matter that mechanically obeys the mind without any intelligence of its own. This misconception led to a second mistake, the idea that the most spiritual people must be those who renounce the body, denigrate its passions, or at the very least attempt to control its desires. This kind of prejudice against the body runs contrary to the very way that nature fashioned us. Nature balanced mind, body, and spirit as co-creators of our personal reality. You cannot do a single thing, from falling in love to uttering a prayer to metabolizing a molecule of sugar, without affecting everything that you are. The body is the platform which allows any experience to emerge and see the light of day. It is a three-dimensional projection of billions of separate processes going on at any moment, including a process as profound as coming to know the reality of God. It may seem totally self-evident to you that your body is basically a physical entity, but that is really a judgment on your part. Granted, it is a judgment shared by millions of people in the scientific age. For example, science tells us that the heart is a pump, an incredibly reliable machine, but one that is liable to mechanical failure at any moment. But you could just as easily claim that the heart is not this tough bundle of twitching muscles. It is the invisible organizing power that creates a very specific organ out of the same atoms and molecules that are found in every life form. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen are the atomic soup that exists in everything alive, from a butterfly wing to a quivering amoeba to a parrot's beak. Inside you, the same building materials could have turned into a stomach or a liver cell instead of a heart cell. except for the unseen intelligence that organized them just this way. That unseen intelligence is yours to command. It flows everywhere in your body, and in fact, every feeling and emotion you have is changing the flow by either a small or a great amount. The whole idea that the heart is a machine is just an image created in our minds, a metaphor we project onto a much richer reality. If you are not spellbound by the metaphor, it is self-evident that the heart is not a pump. It grows, for one thing. At birth, our hearts weighed less than 2 ounces and took more than a decade to reach their final weight of just over a pound. The heart can also alter its own rhythm and stroke volume, self-regulate its timing, sense changes in its environment, and repair damage inflicted by minor heart attacks. What pump does any of that? Then there are feelings associated with my heart. Something in my chest aches with pain, soars with joy, turns hard as flint when it feels distrust, and melts as softly with tenderness as a snowflake in the sun. These are not mere intangibles of emotion. They lead to millions of chemical changes affecting the whole physiology. A depressed person literally has depressed cells. A happy person has happy ones. The difference between the two can be broken down into minute changes of chemical balance, and without these chemicals, you could not be depressed or be happy. You could not have an emotion of any kind. In a very real sense, to be alive is a multi-dimensional act, because so much is happening on so many different levels. They are all levels of one intelligence. In a single moment of life, this intelligence is thinking, feeling, perceiving, breathing, digesting. It is taking in trillions of molecules of food and air and turning them into that mysteriously unique creation called you. At the most subtle level, your inner intelligence is also steadily progressing along the corridors of eternity, although that process is more deeply hidden than the others. Underlying all this bewildering complex activity is one theme, the constant expression of your own needs and desires. Being in touch with your needs is the most powerful way to be in touch with where your inner intelligence is heading at this very moment. This attentiveness makes you a conscious person, someone who is growing and evolving along lines no one else will exactly duplicate, not even the greatest of masters. In Emerson's famous phrase, you are here to enjoy an original relationship to the universe. To be in touch with yourself requires great sensitivity to everything that's going on here and now. The spiritual needs we all have for love, compassion, meaningfulness, total acceptance, devotion, and inner peace are not grand goals to be achieved in a distant time and place. They exist here and now. Spiritual input does not come from another dimension. Your own desires are just manifesting on a subtler level. Compassion is subtler than vitamin C, but both are real needs. And just as the body knows how to process vitamin C and send it where it is required, the inner intelligence of every cell has a profound knowledge of where to find spiritual sustenance and how to use it. Whatever your past conditioning says, your body knows a spiritual deficiency when it feels one. This is because the body wants to be in balance. That is its most profound instinct. Any imbalance can be traced to a state of lack. To live without love, devotion, compassion, or any other spiritual value creates a state of such severe imbalance that every cell yearns to correct it. Ultimately, that is what lies behind the onset of disease. The body is sending a message that some lack is present. An imbalance existing somewhere in inner space that you cannot see or touch has given rise to highly visible, unarguably physical symptoms. Sickness and disease is a change in awareness from comfort to discomfort. awareness has deviated from its self-referral path of happiness, from its self-referral path of bliss. And that is usually due to a frustrated impulse of intelligence, a frustrated desire that cannot be easily fulfilled or accomplished and gets locked somewhere in your quantum mechanical body, changing that experience of the body from comfort to discomfort, dis-ease. Sickness, therefore, is a self-correcting, cybernetic feedback mechanism to allow you to get on the path of bliss, happiness, and the spontaneous fulfillment of all your desires. In order to prevent disease at the most profound level, one does not have to go to any great lengths. The key is to allow your awareness to be present with the body and pay attention to its signals. A gentle focus of attention is all it takes to free the body of minor imbalances. If you are able, shut your eyes right now and sit quietly. What do you notice? Without effort on your part, you'll begin to sense some physical sensation. A twinge in a sore joint, aching in your feet, tight neck muscles. Any source of discomfort acts as a signal of imbalance, and your natural response is to pay attention. Ignoring pain and discomfort imposes a strain because it takes effort to keep your awareness from going where it wants to. Why do we ignore the body's signals? Fear is the most basic reason. A minor pain makes us afraid because we jump to horrible conclusions. And in that instant of fear, as we cringe and draw back, we are letting fear deprive us of a natural response to something the body is trying to say. Where is this minor discomfort actually heading? We never find out because we have all been indoctrinated to feel massive distrust of the body. We automatically identify it with pain and suffering. Yet, if we stand back and ignore all that old conditioning, it becomes clear that pain is not the same as suffering. Suffering is a mental event, an interpretation we put upon the signal of pain. In and of itself, pain is neutral. A marathon runner does not consider the pain in his chest, however painful it becomes, a form of suffering, while a post-operative patient who has just received a bypass graft may be terrified of chest pain, which is even much milder. In labor, a mother willingly goes through pain without identifying it with suffering. Quite the contrary, she will most likely identify it with the joy of childbirth, and that gives her the strength to accept the pain without judgment. Learning to untangle pain from suffering is only the beginning. Once you realize that you have control over any interpretation you place on your body, an enormously liberating idea begins to dawn. The body is on your side. Its signals are messages from a friend. And far from being threatening, these signals are either asking for help or offering it. Shut your eyes again and allow your awareness to wander where it will. The sensations that you start to feel, let's say it's coming from a tight neck muscle, are asking for healing. The fact that you are paying attention to a sensation is what brings the healing. The mind is answering the body's request. That famous phrase, the inner healer, is nothing but this, the natural response of your inner intelligence to a request for help. A friend to a friend, one part of you is joining with another in compassion. Yet there is more than compassion at work, for the act of paying attention contains tremendous power. Think of a crying child who turns peaceful and happy as soon as its mother pays attention to it. The same response occurs in the body. Any cell, tissue, or organ is capable of crying for attention, and when you give it some, the healing process begins. Our society has ignored this fundamental process and paid a high price for it. We have created an overwhelmingly wasteful, expensive, frightening, and inhuman medical system based on the myth that healing belongs in the hands of professionals. We have ignored our own power to heal, becoming blind to the subtle signals of discomfort and imbalance inside our bodies, so that we finally have no choice but to take the advanced cancer or the blocked coronary artery to a specialist. Healing is a conscious activity, and in order to reclaim your inner healer, you must go about it consciously. The task begins with simple awareness. Sit and be aware of yourself. If possible, do this right now. Let your attention go where it wants. Turn off your tape player and spend a minute or two at this right now. I'm sure you noticed that a minute of conscious attention seems like a long time. In addition, your mind probably went just not to one place in your body, but to several. And in between physical sensations, you were no doubt distracted by thoughts and emotions. These two are part of the healing process, because bodily signals naturally blend into and become part of mental signals. A hurt shoulder can remind you of a hurtful thought. It could also lead to reveries that help dispel the hurt. Anything is possible and anything works because it is all attention. But there is one thing especially that I'd like you to notice. So close your eyes again and without making a special effort, let the sensations come and go, seeing them as clouds passing across the sky. Don't stay with any one particular cloud. Just let your thoughts, feelings and sensations come and go as they will. Now, as you do this, see if you can become gently aware of the sky, the background against which these clouds are flowing. That is, gently notice the uninvolved witness, the seer who is observing all that is happening inside of you. You see, when you start watching your thoughts or your mind, then you become aware of yourself as not the mind, but the watcher. As you watch the mind, you become aware of yourself as the watcher. All right, pause the tape now, close your eyes, and practice this procedure if you're able to. The purpose of this exercise is to let you see, however briefly, that you are not your thoughts. You are the witness, the observer. As the clouds pass by, the sky is unchanged. As sensations pass through the mind, you are unchanged. Like a movie screen, your awareness gets constantly bombarded with thousands of images. But that does not mean that you must be attached to those images. Is the screen attached to the movie? Of course, we all get caught. We all get attached because those images inside us are our movie. The drama affects us deeply. Even so, the healing mind is the part of yourself that does not get so involved. To understand this more fully, we need to explore the various layers of impulses as they come into the mind and get converted into the body. By doing this, we empower ourselves to heal ourselves and to live a life without limitations. The fact that you notice a thought does not mean you are watching it being born. Far from it. Thoughts are born deep in the unconscious mind, and the level at which you happen to notice them changes all the time. If you are absorbed in your work, you can ignore a headache for hours. If fear of failure is too threatening to be faced, you can suppress it for years. If you think that getting angry at those you love is wrong, you can convince yourself that you actually have no anger in you. Awareness can be endlessly manipulated because you have so much power over it. However, if inner intelligence is allowed to flow without being manipulated, it moves from subtle to gross. This means that every impulse begins in the silent depths of the mind, moves up through levels of thought, emotion, and feeling, and finally emerges as an expression on the physical level. Being alive, which we called a multidimensional act, is like a wave pulsing upward from the invisible to the visible, from a region the senses cannot register to one that they can. The closer you can get to that invisible source, the greater your healing power. What this translates into, in practical terms, is very simple. A quiet mind is all you need. By far, the most powerful way to discover the quiet mind is through meditation, using the process of transcending. Transcending is the mind's own way of unfolding to itself. Any value of inner silence is valuable. The deepest silence contains the most powerful form of awareness. As it is allowed to expand, silent awareness seeks out the old wounds and begins to mend them. The important principle here is that the subtler one's awareness, the more powerfully it can heal. Healing takes place when the mind and consciousness are silent. How does a fertilized ovum become a fully formed baby with all these organs and a heart and a brain and a liver and a skeleton? In the quietness of awareness. It's not thinking to itself, you know, should I make a liver, should I do this? And the mind is completely quiet. Nature functions through silent efficiency. This is called the principle of least action and maximum effectiveness. Look at it in nature. What do we see? We hardly see any effort. Do you see any effort in birds migrating from one part of the world to another? Or in the earth spinning on its own axis with the precision and accuracy that will confound any computer? Or the earth hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour? Or the orchestration of the blooming of flowers with the onset of spring, and all the activity in nature, the government of nature is silent, completely silent. And it involves the principle of least effort. Do less, accomplish more. Ultimately, do nothing and you'll accomplish everything. The higher self is that place where everything is accomplished by doing nothing. A mere desire becomes the trigger for transformation. When the mind is silent and quiet, then inner energies wake up and work miracles on your behalf without any conscious effort on your part. Again, this brings us face to face with a cultural bias. We were all raised to believe that we have to work for what we want, that the harder we work, the greater the rewards. However, there are some things that require no work, and healing is one of them. You don't have to work to achieve a silent mind. You don't have to work to let your attention flow freely. You don't have to work to find the old wounds. All these things are a given once they are uncovered. The uncovering begins wherever you are now, but its goal is always the same, the revelation of wholeness that unites body, mind, and spirit as one. When you close your eyes and go within, you cannot help but start where you are. The sensations that come to your mind are totally yours, totally unique. Perhaps you do not fully trust where you're going as your mind begins to unfold to itself, but trust builds up over time. Be easy with yourself, and the rest will unfold as it should. Once you start paying attention to your body and letting it express its needs, things will start to change. One has to be a little vague here because no two people are alike, and therefore the process of coming back into balance cannot be mapped out in advance. Realize that your body is a printout of extremely variable information. You're constantly projecting your old conditioning, your beliefs and self-images from the past. Through this filter comes your present awareness, your present thoughts, feelings, and emotions in all their incredible variety. At deeper levels, your subconscious is trying to rid itself of old charged emotions while expressing other basic instincts. And since much of this material contains things you fear and dislike, your mind is constantly interpreting to itself, turning bad into good, or at least tolerable. Some pain is so deep, however, that it cannot be faced at all. It goes into that vast no man's land of denial. Even so, your body is printing out everything, moment by moment. If all the bad things, the fears and old conditioning, and all these suppressed instincts and denied emotions had the upper hand, you would have a hard time living a healthy moment. However, life is not predominantly fearful. It is intelligent, conscious, and full of joy. So is your body. Although islands of pain and discomfort exist in it, they are surrounded by an ocean of pure joy, of comfort, of bliss. When you trace any living impulse back to its source, this bliss is what you reach. We all live our lives from the top down. That is, we notice the grossest expression first. The outburst of anger, the bags under the eyes, the depressed mood. Only then do we undertake an investigation into the subtler causes for these problems, if we seek them at all. Nature works in reverse, from subtle to gross. To nature, your body is bliss first and foremost, a joyful creation whose intent is to live forever. Know that as yourself, and you will exist in a different world. As the ancient Indian sages proclaimed, from bliss these creatures emerged, in bliss they are sustained, into bliss they will merge again. This truth does not dawn all at once. There's a process of purifying the old conditioning that comes first. As each impurity is released, an overall transformation takes place. The body's intelligence regroups itself. It literally recreates itself around a new and purer image. All of us experience this whenever we recover from an illness. The moment comes when the feeling of being sick, accompanied by various symptoms, by fatigue and usually depression, and by a certain inertia in the mind and body, gives way to being well again. I'm a new person, you say, and you're right. Your body is printing out a new creation that is healthy instead of sick. As spiritual growth proceeds, these transformations take place every day. As inner intelligence flows to where it is needed, impurities are released in the form of old stresses. As they go, the entire printout changes. You automatically become integrated on a higher plane of functioning. On some days, you will feel surges of growth. Joyful moods begin to emerge. Former fears and inhibitions vanish, or at least partially melt away. Unexpected strengths seem to be in place. Most astonishing of all, you find that you know things that you never knew before. What you're really doing is tapping into your own informational fields and eavesdropping on the cosmic computer, on the cosmic mind. See, people who are intuitive, they don't go out there to be intuitive. They go inside themselves because our bodies are focal points in a universal field of intelligence. So when we get in touch with that finest feeling, that finest level of feeling, that faintest emotion, that finest impulse of desire, we're tapping into an information field. We tap into that information field, we eavesdrop on the cosmic mind. This is the basis of intuition, of precognition, of knowledge that the seers arrived at even thousands of years ago, which is now being substantiated by modern science. I don't mean necessarily that this knowledge is in the form of technical information, although even that can happen. This knowledge comes in the form of insight. You begin to see what makes other people tick. Your own hidden motivations reveal themselves. Old fears appear in a new, less threatening light. The growth of insight tells you that purification is taking place, not just in the mind, but in every cell. There are times when this process of purification and integration is not so noticeable. People who consider themselves in the spiritual path can be shocked when they have a sudden outburst of anger. Contracting a serious illness can fill them with deep doubts. Such things aren't supposed to happen to spiritual people, and yet sometimes they do. Perfection is a real possibility for everyone, but the way to reach it is by letting go of imperfection. In that letting go, there are bumpy moments and major crises. They are crises of growth. All of us have different levels of trust in the process. Fortunately, the process builds trust as it goes forward by itself. We metabolize our experiences and we convert them into the body. You and I are different because we've walked through different gardens and knelt at different graves. Every little experience, every little wisp of experience that has come our way, we have metabolized it and made it into our body. And as we now go into higher states of awareness, we metabolize those experiences too. They also store the knowledge of higher realities, complete and formed, and they are ready for you to unfold them. Be easy with yourself and know that you are growing all the time. Your body knows how to purify itself. It contains everything you need to recreate yourself into a new being day by day. In truth, you have been doing that all along. Now the process has become conscious. So awareness is the key. You are repairing the leaks in your little boat, and soon it will be strong enough to carry you to the far shores of infinity. So let's begin by trying to see how we can free our desire nature and not be so complicated about what we want. People are very concerned about how much to give and how much to expect from life. Am I loved enough? Do others love me enough in return? Am I being paid what I'm really worth? How much money do I dare hope for? Although we spend endless hours hoping, scheming, and working to achieve our desires, the whole enterprise falls very short of what nature intended for us. Nature wants to give us everything. That means infinite fulfillment, all that your heart desires, and then more, for you are desiring from a heart that has much more room for expansion. Presently, your awareness cannot absorb the concept of having everything. It immediately transforms such a preposterous statement into a reduced version, such as, "Don't bother about everything, I'd be happy with a new Jaguar, or $3 million, or a beautiful wife." As the mind shrinks to its level of acceptance, what is it doing? First of all, it is bouncing back to its own level of awareness. If you have $5,000 instead of $5 million, that reflects your general level of awareness. Secondly, when the mind rejects the possibility of having everything, it expresses its doubts. "Why should I believe in you?" the mind says, and it has no choice but to doubt, for doubts form the chief boundary that encloses us within our narrow consciousness. If the mind could expand beyond its doubt and self-limitation, it would see that having everything does not mean that every kind of material success comes your way, although that possibility should not be ruled out either. Having everything is just an expression of complete inner freedom. When you are completely free of boundaries, you don't have to have a huge number of material things. You already own something far more precious. You own yourself. You see yourself as someone who accepts everything, therefore you have everything. This is not just a play upon words. If the new BMW, the $3 million, the beautiful wife are true desires in your heart, nature will not deny them to you. Above all, nature wants you to have everything. But the all-important point is that having everything happens in consciousness, not in the outside world. Someone who owns absolutely nothing can still have it all inside. When the desire nature is completely set free, the main thing that happens is that your status, the way you see yourself, changes profoundly. Instead of seeing yourself in the world, you truly do see the world in you. You are the co-creator of the world, a position you share with the highest universal intelligence that we refer to as God. Your individual role is to manifest the things you desire from life. As you attain them, your sense of being a creator steadily enlarges until you realize that everything is available to you. This is the state of total freedom. Telling yourself that you have complete free will, that all possibilities are open to you at every second, that no power is greater than yourself, will not bring freedom. These are all true statements, but they are true at a level of consciousness that has to be attained in reality. Presently, if you have a certain limitation, it seems quite real. If you try to wish it away, it inevitably reappears. Seen from the perspective of your higher self, all fears are unnatural. But there is no substitute for proving it to yourself. If you are poor and someone gives you money, you will not automatically be released from the mindset, which is the conditioned consciousness that created your poverty. But if you earn the money yourself in a fashion that increases your self-awareness, the belief that tied you to poverty will be weakened. One step has been taken in the unfolding path that leads to freedom. The end of this path will come when you have fully absorbed the awareness that you are free. It's a very natural feeling. Being free brings a lightness, a carefree surrender to all that is happening around you, and above all, an acceptance of reality. What is simply what is. You allow it and you rejoice in it.